Welcome to the Poisoner's Cabinet. I'm Sinead.
And I'm Nick.
And this is your weekly podcast exploring the lives of the great poisoners and macabre murders from across the centuries and creating curious cocktails inspired by the tales that we tell. And it's episode 101!
101. Room. Are we on room 101?
We might be.
Ah, can I put you in room 101?
Okay, we've started off just mean, haven't we? Episode 101, and we're not covering room 101, not just doing a retelling of 1984. That would be weird.
Are we not? Okay.
No, can if you want.
No, it's probably best we don't.
It will just be a list of things about me that you want to commit to a big cupboard. So, a little caveat, Nick and I are very snuggled up together in this recording, not for any, you know, friendship reasons.
Oh, God, no.
We're down to one mic. Nick's mic decided to die a dramatic death before recording, so if the sound quality on this is a little different, we apologise. We can only do so much, but we hope that this will come out beautifully and you won't even notice it. But it's like we're right next to each other.
Have you got COVID? Go away.
No.
Well, we should be wearing masks, I feel.
No, the COVID doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, that's true.
To Boris Johnson.
Yes, as of today.
As of today,
as
there
of
we
today,
go.
COVID is no more.
Yeah, that's why the mic died. Yeah, it's very weird looking at you, but I'm gonna.
It's very bizarre. It's very bizarre. I don't like it.
We are gonna start fighting like teenagers in a minute. Like, you're touching me. You're on my side of the desk. Well, how are you, Nick?
I'm fine. This is my side of the microphone. Go away. Go away.
He really hit me there. I just gaze into your eyes.
No, don't do that. It's very disturbing.
I may sound a little husky. I was in a pub earlier and a woman wearing the world's strongest perfume sat right next to me. And I nearly died.
Yeah, a lot of sniffing, coughing, sort of thing going on right in my ear. It's been really nice.
Yeah, bodes well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to this one.
Happy, happy episode for Nick. Any poisonings this week, Nick?
Arg. No.
Arg. Sounded like the end of the
Buffy.
End of Buffy, yeah.
I have been watching Buffy, though, I have to say.
Have you? Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, indeed.
Been poisoning yourself with good TV.
Absolutely. Found it on Disney Plus.
Buffy's on Disney Plus.
Yeah, it's great.
The children of today, honestly.
Yeah. And Angel as well.
Angel, a bit more dramatic.
A bit more dramatic, Angel. Yeah,
a lot of flappy coats going on.
I used to love a flappy coat. I still do, to be honest.
Oh, you do. I've seen pictures of you in your youth.
Always
you
terrifying.
And your flappy coats and your big hats.
Was not a good look.
But no poisonings.
No. Apart from big hats and flappy coats.
Yeah. I've only been poisoned by other people's perfume. Old lady perfume
old
as well.
Old lady perfume.
What is it about old ladies and their perfume? Is it just they're covering the stench of death? I don't know. Like rolling around in lavender and rose and something else. It's not right. Maybe it was just this old lady, but it hurts my throat. Well, speaking of being poisoned by perfume and rolling around in various scents while watching Buffy, I think it's time for us to thank our delicious Patreon subscribers.
Yes, what a fantastic weekend that sounds like. thank you very much to Aaron Nelson.
To Shannon Daniel.
And to Tony Viola.
And to Matt Karowski.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, you're very sexy.
Very good.
Very sexy. And we have a shout out this week from lovely Kylia Kinyon, who wants to do a shout out to Spencer Wallace, who turns 25 years old on the 28th of February. Happy birthday, Spencer.
Many birthdays to you.
Have many, many, many alcohols.
At least four.
We've had fun on Patreon this week. We talked about the real vampires of Serbia, which is
yes.
Like the real housewives of
Chelsea or something.
I mean, that would be a great mashup.
Much better version. I would watch that.
Sorry, the real housewives of Chelsea. Is that a series?
Made in Chelsea. I have like mashed loads of random series together in my head.
With vampires.
With
now.
Vampires.
That's amazing.
Sounds great.
Well, Nick, are you ready?
Yeah, no.
I'm going to get really close to you and say it. I'm going to whisper in your ear. Oh, no, you made eye contact. God damn it, he called my bluff. Oh, he made eye contact and it was too much. Ooh. Are you ready to drink cocktails, talk about poison?
It's too weird. I want poison, to be honest.
You want poison?
I want this to be over.
You want this to be over? Okay, so you would rather drink poison and talk about cocktails?
Than sit on the same side of a table as you, yes.
My feelings are starting to get hurt, Nick. Well, play your cards right. And should we go with the first one?
Okay, yes, let's do that.
Okay, let's drink cocktails and talk about poison. My story this week, hooray, hooray, hooray. But as you know, we can't possibly have a story without a cocktail in hand. As you know, dear listeners, every week we choose a secret ingredient that is inspired by the tale that we tell and will flavour our cocktail of the week. My story this week, so my pick. And this week's secret ingredient is, Nick, A cigar. A cigar. A classic accompaniment to a drink.
This is true.
Not a classic ingredient, a cigar ash flavour in a drink, I'm not sure about.
Well, I mean, you could go down the smoky route.
Ooh, I do like you something
could, you
smoky.
You could do something smoky. You could do a smoked old-fashioned and things like that. You could do a smoky thing. Or a smoky beverage, like a mezcal, something like that. Smoky,
ooh,
or whiskey,
nice.
Smoky. I didn't do any of that.
Oh, you didn't do any of that?
No, I didn't do any of that.
Well, I was thinking, could you evoke some sort of gentleman's club? You know, like leather armchairs.
Absolutely, a nice Chesterfield.
Anyway, none of that.
None of that happened.
Okay, right. Well, with cigar as the ingredient, what have you come up with?
So, I've come up with... I did actually consider making previously, and I don't think I did. You're going to tell me now we've already had this, which I hope we haven't.
This sometimes happens on the show, where right up until where we say it, we went... And we know this.
Anyway, so we are going to have, whether we've had it or not, we're going to have a 100-year-old cigar.
Oh, I don't think we have had
good.
This.
Good, I'm glad.
I've not heard of it, or I've wiped it from my mind.
So it has some interesting ingredients.
Okay.
I thought. Ooh. That's what I thought. I thought.
A 100-year-old cigar.
100-year-old cigar.
That could either be something wonderful, like something that's in a humidor, really nice flavours, or it's just awful. It's just ash.
It could be awful.
And rotten flesh.
Rotten flesh in cigars.
I'm not sure how cigars are made. I'm not going to lie to you. I thought it was just flesh.
I think it's on the thigh of a virgin, not the thigh of a corpse.
Rolled on the thigh of a virgin. A dead virgin. Oh, God, that took a turn, didn't it?
Essence of flesh in there, that's what you want.
Grave diggers just hauling corpses. Yes, roll the cigar. This is a very strange profession we've developed.
Absolutely.
Excellent. 100-year-old cigar. I'm excited because there'll be alcohol.
There shall certainly be alcohol.
And it'll make this coziness less awkward. We should caveat that Nick and I have known each other for many, many, many years. We spend a lot of time together. We just never really sit close to each other.
No.
We're not touchy-feely.
Far away as possible.
I try and hug him every now and then, and he just like bats me away with the stick. I'm like, come on, come on. So let's get drunk.
Okay.
I think it is high time for us to go into the poisoner's cabinet kitchen and shake up a storm. So we'll see you in a minute.
We'll see you in a bit.
And we're back.
Hello.
Ooh, Nick. 100-year-old cigar. Ooh, it looks very pretty.
It's brown.
It's brown. It's a kind of a ruby brown.
It is, yes. It's a reddy brown.
A reddy brown.
It's a rusty brown.
a rusty. That's very nice. Rusty brown. Mm-hmm. Now, we like the brown drinks.
Brown drinks are good.
Brown drinks generally keep us happy.
Keep us insane.
But in a good way.
In a good way. Is there a bad way to be insane?
Oh, have you listened back to the absinthe episodes?
Yep, we might be on one of them now.
Yay! Excellent. Okay, so we are... Move over, Nick! Okay, so we're arm in arm.
She's touching me!
Ew! I'm touching your forearm, Nick. Let's link arms. Oh, Nick,
no.
Should we do the romantic thing where we like wrap our arms around each other, like, you know, the hands? Where
you
do the wrappy handy thingy.
But no.
Yeah, like it's our wedding, Nick. Don't pretend this isn't what our future's going to be. We're both going to end up alone together.
Oh, that's something to look forward to.
Oh, it smells of alcohol.
Oh, good.
It smells strong. Okay, right, well, so... Oh, clinky, clinky.
Clinky. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Latoya Jackson.
Oh, that's...
That's a lot.
That's got a move to it.
Whew, I can see through time.
Oh, that's nice. I like. That is very much a me sort
that's
of drink.
That's a very you
and
drink.
And it's very not a you drink.
Oh, what's happened to my taste buds? What?
Oh, I'm going in again. I like this.
Go in again.
Yum, 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 yum.
The second sip is better.
That's good. Oh, it's good. Bring it on.
Oh, it's a Nick drink, guys. There's some complex flavours in there. Oh, I want to guess at many, and I don't think that any of them would be right, but...
Guess, I'm intrigued.
Oh, it got a lot of mouth stuff going on.
It's got a lot of mouth stuff. These are nice technical experience terms you'll get from the Poison's Cabinet podcast.
You don't need to listen to Diffords or, you know, read the books. Just listen to me going, got mouth stuff.
It's got mouth stuff. Oh, there's at least three on the mouth stuff scale.
Okay.
Yes.
So it feels
Mouthy, yes, we've got
mouthy,
that.
Mouthy, mouthy. A stirred drink rather than a shaken.
Most certainly.
Yeah, so there's no citrus in here at all. Oh, God, I feel like it's got some variety of vermouth in there and it's dark liquors. This is going to sound so weird. Does it have any mint in it?
It does not have any mint in it.
It's got almost, I don't know whether it's the alcohol effect, but it's got that sort of almost menthol aftertaste. Do you know what I mean? Not that it tastes like overtly of mint, but you know that.
Yes, it's got a slightly herbaceous quality to it. And it's not the thing you're thinking of, so don't worry.
Okay, good. Yeah, talk us through it, Nick. What's happening?
There's a lot happening. There's an awful lot happening. In a drink like this, you would quite right look at it and go, oh, there's a sweet vermouth in there or something like that. There is not.
Oh, okay.
There is a different type of Amaro that we'll come to. But we've got a base of rum, of dark rum.
Ooh, nice.
An aged 7-year rum. It's very nice.
Okay.
So we've got a base of that. We then have some Benedictine.
Oh, that is the thingy.
That is one of the thingies.
That is one of the herbally, medicine-y. That's it.
Yes, which we have not used on the podcast
before. Not used Benedictine.
Because I had to buy a bottle for this cocktail. So we've not used it before.
I think people have mentioned Benedictine in the past. Quite acquired.
Oh, indeed. Not something like you'd have on the rocks or just as a little shot or something like that. But in a cocktail, I think it's very pleasant. Mm. We also have the Chinar, the bottle that we bought many, many moons ago for one cocktail, and it's sat in the back of the cupboard ever since.
Yeah.
That, again, which is going to add to your herby artichokiness.
Yes, because it's got artichokes.
It's made from artichoke.
It's made from artichoke. It's not just got an artichoke in it. It's not vodka with an artichoke in it.
No, it's made from artichoke. We have that. We have some bitters. And to round it all off, we have a nice absinthe rinse.
No! I walked into it, didn't I? Like, oh, well, this doesn't have absinthe in it.
To ensure full insanity is accomplished, there is a nice chilled absinthe rinse in the glass. It's very nice.
Oh, good Lord.
So, when I picked it up, I thought, ooh, there's the aniseed smell that you get.
It does, yeah, it has that. Oh, it's like a party in my mouth and everyone's fighting.
That is one that I'm going to be making again.
Really?
Oh, and there's something else. I forgot, there's another thing. Oh,
Jesus Christ, how much is in this?
We also have some really peaty whiskey. We have Lafroig.
You have Lafroig in here too?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tiny amount. We're looking about a sixth of an ounce to add to that sort of smoke. Well, I suppose cigar smoky.
Yes. Yes.
It's going on there. But wow. That's a tiny amount, but I think, it adds to that hint of smokiness in the background.
That is an amazingly complex but very well done cocktail.
It's a very nice cocktail.
It is very much an acquired taste.
Yeah. Absolutely, yes.
I think maybe I'm actually being harsh there. I don't think it's very much like completely like, oh, you'll hate it or you'll love it. It's a very good cocktail. Yeah, you've got to be into your slightly more herbal.
Absolutely. This is not
There's the absinthe suddenly. I've just, there it is. There it's turned up now.
This is not one for going to your local cocktail bar and ordering on a Saturday night out.
God no. God no.
this is unless it was 1 a.m. or something like that and your cocktail bar is open and you're there in front of a fire and then you have one of these before bed or something.
After you've had a fine meal of partridge.
Exactly.
Discussing Wittgenstein and Love is Blind over a lovely, lovely dinner. Precisely. And then you go, 100-year-old cigar, please.
In your Chesterfield with your cigar.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I could get down with that.
Yeah, exactly. In that situation, I think this would be spot on.
You would be completely at home in that situation.
I would love that situation. Yeah,
any situation where you're in a lovely Chesterfield
with a fine drink
and good company, hopefully your own company probably.
That's the best.
And I would be sitting next to you being terribly, terribly confused, going, do I like this? I don't know. I don't know what's happening. And I would just stagger around for your amusement.
Yeah.
That would be it.
That's good.
Would you make this again?
I would definitely make this again.
Really?
Yeah, definitely make this one again.
I'm not saying it's awful that why you wouldn't. It's really complex though. But you've got all the ingredients now.
This is my sort of drink. If I'm home and it's a Friday night and I'm in by myself, listening to some music or something like that, happily make one of these.
Definitely.
And it'll last half an hour or something.
Exactly. It's
just
not going
to
be
a book or listen to music. Lovely.
And it's not one that you're going to suddenly make 3 or 4
Absolutely
of those.
Not, no.
One,
because you will be dead.
Maybe 2, and the second one would be a mistake.
Yeah. Perfect evening.
Oh, lovely. I feel like I should go.
Well, you're here now. We might as well finish.
No. Well, you just down that. And it's also got absinthe in it, so we will go insane on this show if anyone remembers from any of the other absinthe-based cocktails we've had.
Best one we've had in a long time.
Wow, I've never seen you so happy.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
I'm really glad this has worked out for you, actually.
So we've had a run of a bit of crappy ones.
Okay ones.
Okay ones, not inspiring ones. This is good. I'm just going to drink this and then steal yours. And
pretty much, yeah. I'll just be crying in a corner trying to read a story while Nick goes, I will tell you about the old times.
I will tell you about the old country.
What, Ramsgate?
Yeah, yeah. Very old.
It's very old.
Very, very old.
Well, with our...
Back in 1836.
With our 100-year-old cigars clasped in hand, Nick, settling into our Chesterfield sofas, are you ready for a story?
Let's get on with it. I've got to fuck you.
Oh, he's got a ruler, people.
So now I'm
Who
very
gave
close?
Him a ruler?
Be more funny!
He's literally poking me in the arm. My BCG! Right, are you bloody ready for a story?
Go on then, get on with it.
So I'm going to read you the opening line from a BBC article from 2017.
That's quite modern.
Scientists trying to identify a man who burned to death 8 decades ago say they are yet to find a DNA match.
I mean, it's slow news day, I feel.
Yes, I love these kind of stories where it's going, the news is, there is no news.
Yeah, the news is, nothing happened, nothing happened at all.
Pretty much. But it's a great promise of a story, isn't it? A man who burned to death 80 years ago.
80 years ago. And we know nothing more now than we did then.
Who is he? What happened? Ooh. Why are the authorities trying to identify the body of a man dead for more than 80 years? And what happened to him to cause such curiosity? Well, Nick, to find out, we must go back. Back.
80 years?
Yeah.
Okay.
To 1930. And it is Guy Fawkes Night.
Ooh, a lot of fire there.
Ooh, a lot of fire. It's actually 2 a.m. after.
So he wasn't on the wrong end of a firework.
You can make your judgments on this.
Okay.
Two men, cousins, named Alfred Brown and William Bailey, are walking home along Hardingston Lane from a Guy Fawkes Night dance in Northampton.
Very civilised.
I don't know if they attended the dance together as a couple. It didn't say... I like to imagine that they did. Just to add a little extra colour in there.
Okay.
They were just defying society's norms at the time.
Yeah.
But they were walking home. As they wander through the streets, they suddenly see a rather well-dressed man carrying a briefcase emerging from a ditch.
Okay. That's where all well-dressed men live.
Just pops up, walks past them in the other direction. Morning. Off he goes on the way towards the road towards London.
Oh.
When they were later asked, are you sure of what you saw? One of them would say in court, when you go home at that time in the morning, you do not usually see well-dressed men getting out of a ditch.
He has a point, I feel.
Indeed. As the man passed them, he said, looks like someone's having a bonfire up there, and then runs off into the night. And the chaps turn back to their route, and they do see a glow in the distance of what indeed seems to be like another bonfire from the night celebrations. But as they get closer, they realise that this is no ordinary fire meant for burning Catholics.
The best type of fire.
It's got to be extra hot. We're a tricky people. They're
notoriously difficult to burn, are those Catholics.
We chat a lot. What they found instead was a car, a Morris Minor, ablaze, with flames reaching up to 12 foot high. And the men hurriedly raised the alarm and brought the fire brigade and the police to the scene to extinguish the flames. At first, the guys who were there and the local PC has to gather water from a nearby pond to try and extinguish the flames. But the car was burnt out almost entirely. The license plate remained visible, which is a good sign. But as they examined the wreckage, they found in the front seat the charred remains of a human being.
Yeah.
The body so devastated by fire, it is impossible to identify them. The head, burned free of the body, was lying on the driver's seat.
Nice.
They note that the right arm has burnt off at the elbow. So this is giving you an idea of just how charred this corpse is. One police officer at the scene said that he thought the head on the seat was a rugby ball.
Oh, nice.
I think that was probably him trying to make the best out of that situation.
Yeah.
It's a human head. No, it's a rugby ball.
No, it definitely is. Definitely not.
I'm not acknowledging this. 100% no. So examining the scene, there is really no indication of what has happened, other than they found a mallet by the vehicle on the ground, a wooden mallet. It seems to have some human hairs on it, but no other detritus, nothing else, just a couple of hairs. That's it.
Okay.
This is no ordinary incident, they surmise. A man has died in his vehicle. They must identify him at once, and using the license plate, they trace the car to one Alfred Rouse, a married 37-year-old man with a family from Finchley in London. A horrific end for anyone to endure.
But he's in the passenger seat.
It's not, they can't really tell what seat he's in. It's just completely been devastated. So who was the well-dressed man, though?
Well, this is very true.
Who was seen walking along the road at 2 a.m. A well-dressed man carrying a briefcase is a bit weird to see at 2 a.m, particularly when you're leaving the scene of what is apparently a crime. Well, you must find him, said someone, probably.
One would hope.
Well, we'd hope. I don't know if anyone does stand up at their desk in these cases going, we must find him. All right, Gerald, calm down. The authorities release an artist's impression of the man to the media, including to a paper named The Daily Sketch at the time. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of The Daily Sketch?
I have heard of The Daily Sketch.
In the meantime, the police visited poor Mrs. Rouse, the wife of the man who owned the car, to break the horrible news that they found the vehicle, they have found a body inside. The distraught woman could not confirm anything about the vehicle. They keep showing her pictures and bits and pieces, and she's like, I can't this is a wreck. This is ash on the ground. They didn't show her pictures of the corpse, which is a good thing, or the actual corpse. And they were like, could you tell? Why would you do this? But she was brought into ID, scraps of clothing, a wallet was found on the scene. She said she couldn't identify the clothing, but the wallet was her husband's. So it's not looking good.
Not looking encouraging, no.
For them. But the sketch sent to the media seems to have worked. For in a wee village in the Welsh Vale of Glamorgan, Miss Phyllis Jenkins bought a copy of the Daily Sketch and was horrified to see the face of the man who had arrived at her house the night before.
Oh.
This man was engaged to her younger sister, Ivy, and Ivy was carrying his child. And his name was Alfred Rouse.
Ooh, a double life.
Da, da, da.
Oh, that's a dramatic twist.
The owner of the car, the man everyone thought was dead, the victim of a terrible crime, was alive and well and shacked up with someone who was not his wife.
Oh, how rude.
Now, obviously, Ivy and her family have questions.
Yes.
And they show Alfred the article, the newspaper. What the hell is going on? And he goes, nope, it's not my car. It's not my car. It's definitely not my car. And they say, that may well be, but your bloody picture is in the bloody paper. You've been identified. And he asks to see the paper, and Ivy hands it to him, and he folds it up and puts it in his pocket and runs out of the house.
I mean, that's the behaviour of an innocent man. Nothing to hide there, I feel.
Yeah, he may not run, but he definitely leaves the house. Probably her going, come back, you shit. He's just out of there. Back to London. Back to London. He's heading in that direction.
So he's running.
running. Running to a bus.
He went out of the house and turned left towards London.
Exactly. Straight on till morning. No, he has fled his hiding place in Wales, going back to London. Why? We don't know. It doesn't seem wise to be heading back there where his wife is. But the Cardiff police are tipped off by Ivy and Phyllis Jenkins' family, the sisters. They inform Scotland Yard that that's where he's going. He's obviously said, I'm off to London. They track him down. Alfred steps off his bus at Victoria Station and he is met by the police for questioning. And Albert says, very well, I'm glad it's all over. I was going to Scotland Yard about it.
No, he wasn't.
I am responsible.
Oh.
But it's not quite as cut and dried as he would make it out there and then. So who is Alfred Rouse?
And what is he responsible for?
And what happened in Northampton? So, Alfred Rouse was born in London in 1894. His father was a hoosier.
Okay.
Mother was an actress.
Nice.
But mummy ran off when he was about six.
Oh.
These actresses can't be trusted.
Absolutely not.
It wasn't a happy childhood as a result of mummy running away.
No, I can imagine.
Daddy was not really present as a father.
He's got hose to sell.
He has. Many, many hoes.
Yeah.
Of all varieties.
All variety of hoes.
The kids were mostly raised by an aunt. But Alfred was a good student at school. He left age 14 to gain work at first as an estate agent and then at a textiles firm, following in his daddy's footsteps. Mm-hmm. He also took a lot of evening classes. He practiced music and singing. He played the violin, the mandolin and the piano.
Ooh.
He was someone who, it wasn't remarked that he was remarkably intelligent, but he was smart and he was constantly having hobbies and seeking to better
out
himself.
To learn new things.
Definitely. He
Good
had
for him.
Different careers as well through his life. So he sort of chopped and changed a little bit. Age 20, his career had moved into carpentry and he was going to be working for a furniture manufacturer. And he'd met the lovely Lily Mae Watkins, his wife later, and the pair were soon married and things were all looking up. Then comes 1914.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Not a good year to be a young man. 4 days after war were declared, he signs up to the 24th Queen's Regiment as a private. Now, Albert's war career was good in terms of his commitment to the service, but like any soldier who was deployed to France, he would leave emotionally and physically scarred.
Yeah.
He had face-to-face battles with the enemy that haunted him for the rest of his life. In the Battle of Festubert, he was badly injured by a German shell which exploded very close to his head. It left him with wounds in his head, his knee and his thighs. Very serious injuries. He was in hospital for almost a year.
Oh, Christ.
Underwent numerous surgeries to help him walk again. He was eventually discharged from a military hospital in 1916 on a pension of 16 shillings a week. So he'd had a lot of recuperation. He couldn't work. He would have this pension until he was of better health. The trauma of war obviously has a lasting effect on anyone who's experienced it. But Albert kept drawing on his military pension, complaining of his injuries. The doctors, whether they were doing the best thing or whether they were just going by the book of the time, eventually would say they could find nothing physically wrong with him. After all of his treatment, he was okay. He was capable of working. Yeah. His leg injuries that he kept complaining of were not as bad anymore. He was absolutely capable of holding down a job. He was technically able to live and work without the pension, and so they started to cut his income until it finally stopped in 1920. Alfred kept recuperating by playing different sports. He was an avid tennis player. He studied car maintenance as well, became quite a skilled mechanic. And he also kept up another favourite pastime of his. The ladies.
Okay.
It's a common form of recuperation.
It is, absolutely. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, the honeys, the babes, the fillies. I don't know, whatever they called them at the time.
Say, are they horses?
No, you call ladies fillies as well. Yeah. It's not a very nice term because you're like, oh, the fillies like the horses. Oh, the fillies. You've never heard that before. Also named for a sports team in America. Let's see the Phillies one.
It's not my area of expertise.
Yeah, why am I asking you about ladies or horses or sport?
Three things on which I am happily ignorant.
Alfred, of course, had a rotten time in the war. Wouldn't anyone? But it seemingly did nothing to quell his passions for all of his complaints that he couldn't work or he needed his pension or his leg still hurt did not stop him being an absolute player in the worst sense.
Well, go for it, I say. He's lived through something horrendous.
He is married.
Well, this is also true.
If you're single, go for it, mate.
That's true. I forgot about that bit.
Yeah, don't marry someone and then go and shag around.
No, fair enough.
And even so, he indulged in many, many affairs while he was recovering. Later, when he was working as a mechanic and his profession would take him off to distant places. Yeah, car mechanics famously travel the world.
Absolutely.
If you do have sympathy for him, just bear in mind that he did seduce a 14-year-old girl in Edinburgh.
Yeah, that's less good.
She was pregnant by the time she was 15. And he very much disappeared at that point.
Okay, now he's featuring on the bastardometer now.
Mm-hmm. The bastardometer is starting to quiver. Yeah. I was doing the gesture there.
You were.
a string of ladies in his wake. By 1929, he had found work for Messrs. Martin, and he was a travelling salesman.
Okay.
Selling braces and garters.
Nice.
Perfect if you want to shag around. You're going to go to bored housewives and go, look at these garters, these sexy, sexy garters.
But would you also buy braces at the same time?
Well, maybe he's just twanging them in a suggestive way in the background.
I'm not sure that they're particularly linked items of clothing.
No, but it's really useful. If he turns up and he's going sexy garters for the ladies and he's just flirting with the housewife, husband comes home, mate, pair of braces.
Pair of braces.
I got a pair of braces for you.
Absolutely true. Yeah, this is a cunning plan. He's a wise, wise man.
Cover story. Yeah, there well, okay. it is.
Yeah. I hadn't put it through thoroughly enough.
Now, he was paying for the mortgage on his wife's home, his family home, in inverted commas, in London, but he had affairs with any married or single woman who was willing who crossed his path. Whatever sway he had with the women, we don't know, because I, Nick, have never seen a man who looks more like Hitler in my life.
Well, the thing is, Hitler wasn't a thing at this time.
No, it's not that he wasn't a thing, but he was alive.
Yes.
Yes, so maybe. You don't know. This was his secret ploy.
He was alive, but he wasn't a famous man.
No, but that's what I mean. This is maybe how he started his rise to power. Shagging all the housewives of the UK. And then he was really frustrated by them, going, fuck it, I will kill everyone in Europe.
Yeah, okay.
Well, look at the picture.
Okay.
I'm going to show you a picture.
No, I mean, he's got a pencil moustache.
He looks quite like Hitler.
No, he's got a moustache.
He's got slick back hair and the widow's peak.
There's no widow's peak there.
This bit?
No.
You're saying no to that. Shag him?
Well, no.
There we are.
Apart from the pencil moustache, there is no resemblance to Hitler whatsoever.
Oh, shush. I think he looks like Hitler.
Well, you're wrong.
Well, everyone can vote on this when you see the picture. But yes, well, he's not classically, when you look at him, gorgeous, though.
He's not unattractive.
He's not a troll, no. But he's not... Does shag this many people?
It was obviously he had something. He was obviously very charismatic or suave. He, obviously, if he was a salesman and things like that, he's obviously got... He's probably got the gift of the gab, sort of talks very well and is very persuasive, so...
He was a charmer.
Yeah.
He was a charmer.
Well, you see lots of people going, how the fuck do they shag anyone?
It's very true.
And but it's because they're charming and charismatic and tends to somewhat...
Or negging.
And that sometimes sort of overrides the physical appearance of someone if they're really alluring in that sort of way.
You might be onto something there, because he would seemingly only target poor women. Women of limited education. And he would be very happy to spin them yarns about that he was a very successful London entrepreneur.
Everyone from London is successful.
Absolutely. He could win them over with his charm, win them into his bed, promising them marriage, promising them a wonderful, comfortable life. But, yeah, once they had done the deed a few times, as soon as the women said, okay, the... issue of our love has turned up, he would disappear.
Yeah.
Absolutely bugger off. He would shuffle away, and he could blame these, in inverted commas, ignorant women for their own misfortune.
Why would you not expect that?
Because if a suave, gorgeous man turns up and you are a servant in a house, or you are a lowly woman and suddenly someone's taken an interest and they promise you the world, you believe them because you can spin a yarn. Like, we're older and wiser. Well,
perhaps I'm just more cynical of the world than...
You are now. But I bet you when you were a teenager in your early 20s, you know, you believed, you know, if someone had turned up to you and said, Nick, I will take you away from all of this Ramsgate business... We shall travel the world. The Tindler Swindler turned up for you. You'd have been on that bloody plane.
No, fair enough. You're not wrong. I take it all back.
Maybe that was happening.
No,
but...
you get taken in very easily by these things.
Indeed.
Okay, fair enough.
But there's only so many affairs you can conduct and children you can father before people start asking you for money.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Rightly so. By the time 1930 rolls around, Alfred has at least two orders for child support in his lap, legitimate claims that have been filed, and there is the potential for a lot more to come. It's catching up with him. He probably thought he could get away with it and the women would deal with it themselves, but no, they're coming knocking. You know, you got me into this mess, damn well pay up.
Gotcha.
And this is when he starts to entertain ideas that if he could just disappear... If Alfred Rouse could disappear, wouldn't everything just be much simpler? Suicide? Meh, that seems excessive.
Indeed.
So he starts thinking of ways of faking his own death. His wife and son would have to be supported, of course, so he takes out a life insurance policy on himself, specifically to be paid out should he die in the event of a car accident.
Ooh, that's very specific.
But now Alfred thinks, I can put into motion a plan that will allow me in... a direct quote, to start afresh. In the days leading up to Guy Fawkes' night in 1930, Alfred makes the acquaintance of a man of the same sort of build of him in his local pub, the excellently named The Swan and Pyramid.
Okay. Not two things I would generally associate with each other.
The Swan and Pyramid.
Swan and Pyramid, that's...
I don't understand that link.
No, not in the slightest.
But then there's a lot of crazy pub names out there.
I'm not... yes, there are, but I'm not as crazy
mashing
as
them together. The Swan and Pyramid. Maybe
the
swan a swan,
pyramid is...
Maybe a swan once landed on top of the Great Pyramids of Giza, and people went, that's curious, we should name a British pub of that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many swans there are up and down the Nile.
That's a very good point.
They don't strike me as a particularly sort of... Egyptian bird.
So on the Thames one day, a pyramid of swans formed.
That may have been it.
And when the person saw that and went, okay, I gotta quit drinking. But instead they opened a pub.
Yeah, okay, now we'll go with that.
But he was in the Swan and Pyramid.
Swan and Pyramid, wow.
He found a man who he claimed was down on his luck, unknown to many and seemingly alone in the world. Alfred talked to him and he would later say that the man said, Governor, I've got nobody in the world that cares whether I live or die.
Oh.
Which is really sad.
Sad.
He might as well have just said, no one would care if
now.
I was killed tonight. You could take me outside, put me in a car, set it on fire. Nobody would know about it, mate. Yep. Oh, no, unlucky old me. Alfred promised the man some work. He said, I have work in the Midlands. You know what? I'll drive you up there. I'm going that way. When I meet you, 5th of November. Get in my car, we'll drive up north,
like
mate.
Like a nice trip.
We'll take a nice trip together. Why are you laughing? No reason. No reason whatsoever.
Is it the Swan Pyramid? Because he's there with the Pyramid of Evil Contemplation.
The Pyramid of Evil Contemplation. Everyone who goes in there is making evil
it's
plans.
It's a great pub for plotting and plans.
And that poor man is standing there going, no, I really have got to stop coming in here.
He's the swan.
No, he's the innocent white swan.
He's the innocent white swan.
Surrounded by pyramids of evil contemplation. You can see where the absinthe is kicking in this episode. Alfred did indeed pick up the man, as he said, on Guy Fawkes Night. He picked that day, Alfred would later say, because no one would notice another fire.
Well, that's a fair point. Yeah.
Fair point. And he bought the man a nice big bottle of whiskey.
Nice.
For the journey. Now, what happened next is obviously going to be a mystery, because we only have differing accounts.
Yes.
After Alfred was arrested, he would claim that the man in the car was a hitchhiker whom he had offered a lift to.
Mm-hmm.
When they got to Northampton, the car ran out of fuel. Alfred asked his passenger to go and fill the petrol tank from a can that was conveniently in the boot.
Well, one would have a petrol can in the boot, I feel.
Very much so.
So fair enough.
Alfred goes, you do that while I go and relieve myself in the ditch.
Okay.
Around this time, Alfred, who did not smoke, gave the man, who had been drinking whiskey all day and who was holding a can of petrol, a cigar!
There it is.
He gave the man a cigar. He stuck to this story the whole time. The man in the car lit up the cigar. Boom, the car goes up in flames.
Okay.
That's what he said happened. He said it was an accident. He tried to save him. He tried, but the flames were so strong they beat him back. And so he fled in a panic from this terrible, tragic accident that had occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what he says in the police examinations. Much is made later of forensic evidence found around the car that showed that the carburetor and the fuel tank had been tampered with.
Ooh.
In a way that would allow petrol to leak out of the tank to flood the car to enable an explosion.
Well, he is a mechanic. He's well-versed in the mechanical arts.
There you go. It was also found that the victim had been alive but unconscious when the blaze started and was dead within 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah. The mallet found at the scene, yep, maybe Alfred had clocked him over the head with it, which would explain the hairs on it,
true.
Not blood or matter. It was just a quick tap on the head. Yep, off you go.
Yep.
But still, Alfred, briefcase in hand, fled the scene. Alfred, when he had left the scene, when he was making his way to Wales, it is reported that pretty much everyone he met on the way, he said, my car's been stolen, you know. The bus driver, a man who was serving him coffee, someone he just met and who got a lift off. Yes, my car's been stolen. It's just £5 for the journey. I really don't need to know your backstory.
To think of someone who's obviously planned this quite far in advance, as to he has tampered with the car in such a way that it gets full of petrol, then makes such a stupid thing of going to everyone he meets, oh, my car's been stolen. It seems he obviously has such wherewithal and planning to tamper with the car and things, but then to be so obvious about other aspects seems very bizarre.
Probably panicking. Maybe, and we don't know what happens.
Absolutely. It does seem like a very panicky thing.
In custody, Alfred gave all sorts of conflicting versions of events. He would stick to a story, but the details of them would change. He kept contradicting himself, and this was plenty for the police and later the prosecution to leap on when he went to trial for the murder of an unknown man in January 1931. Alfred pleads not guilty. He sticks to his accidental death story, but his story, as I said, is scatty at best. One Sir Bernard Spilsbury! He confirms that the victim had been alive, indeed, as we said, unconscious when the blaze started, doused with petrol, and the car was doused with petrol and set alight. So this is pretty calculated stuff.
Absolutely.
The prosecution challenge Alfred's claims that the loose pipes in the car that led to the petrol leak could have just been a result of the fire. He just kept claiming, oh no, I didn't tamper with it at all. That was probably something to do with the fire. I'm a mechanic, I know it. Mm. They actually hand him the carburetor in court and go, okay, explain how that happened. And he gets very, very nervous.
Yeah, I can imagine.
He doesn't like it. He doesn't take the stand officially.
Yeah.
to give his defence. But yeah, the prosecution go like, why don't you explain it, Mr. Mechanic? They also call three of his mistresses to the stand, which is never good.
I'm sure they've got a lot to say.
After 6 days of the trial, it takes the jury just 25 minutes to find him guilty. And he is sentenced to death. Just before his execution, Alfred wrote a confession to the Daily Sketch. Having denied it the whole time, he wrote a confession to the Daily Sketch, admitting that he'd indeed known the unknown man, he had strangled him, and then set the car alight.
Just the man he met in the pub. Yeah. He persuaded him.
Yeah. This is an excerpt of the confession that he sent to the Daily Sketch. Nellie Tucker, one of his mistresses, was expecting another child, and I was expecting to hear from Jenkins, Ivy Jenkins, similar news. There were other difficulties, and I was fed up. I wanted to start life afresh. I spoke to a man near me at the Swan and Pyramid public house. He was a down and out, and he told the usual hard luck story. I took him to the public house and he had some beer. I had lemonade, of course. I paid for the drinks. He told me he usually hung about there. He did not tell me his name. And he did say that he had no relations and was looking for work, and that he was in the habit of getting lifts on lorries. He was a sort of man nobody would miss, and I thought he would suit the plan I had in mind. I suddenly realised I should do it on the 5th of November, when a fire would not be noticed so much. I met him outside the Swan and Pyramid on the night that they travelled. We talked a lot on the journey, but he did not tell me who he actually was. I did not care. The man was half dozing, the effect of the whiskey. I gripped him by the throat with my right hand. I pressed his head against the back of the seat. He slid down, his hat falling off. I saw that he had a bald patch on his crown of his head. He just gurgled. I pressed his throat hard. He did not resist.
Oh, God.
Alfred Rouse never asked the victim his name, and we still do not know.
That's harsh. We don't know. Oh, God.
We do not know who he is.
Ooh.
And that is the BBC story that we relate to in the beginning.
Yes.
In 2017, they are still trying to find out who that man was. All we know is that he is aged anywhere between 33 and 40 years old. His lungs, even though he was very badly burnt, were of such a condition that it was thought he worked in a very dusty environment. From Alfred's own description, that he was between 5'6" and 5'8", respectably dressed, he had a slight brogue. He had a boxing or sporting tattoo on his right forearm, and he had been wearing police boots, which Rouse claimed the man had informed him had been given to him by the London police. But that's all we know about the victim of the blazing car murder.
Probably we never will know who he was.
Mm. But Alfred Rouse was hanged for his murder.
Well, as he should be.
And that is the story of the blazing car murder.
Blazing car murder. That's a very dramatic title for it.
Da, da, da.
Yeah, I like that. That's good.
You like that one?
That's a good story.
Yay!
That's a good story. Lots of twists and turns going on there.
Yeah, you see? We haven't done a lot of faking your own death stories.
No, we haven't at all. And no. That may well be the first
It may be
done.
The first one. Actually. I think people have tried to cover their tracks and
tried
to make him escape. But this is one where the guy just cold-heartedly chose a fella in the local pub and decided, yeah, you're the same build as me. No one's going to miss you.
Yeah.
Put him in the car and literally murdered him. Yeah.
That's slightly terrifying.
And it's portrayed in such a way, not obviously in the courts, but as the story of like, oh, well, this man just died in a car. It's like, he killed him.
Yeah.
He was very happy to let him die
so
he wouldn't have to pay all of the child support he was owing.
But it's a strange thing, though, because without a name or anything, without a background or without family to scream and shout and things, people like that, they would just, unfortunately, just get forgotten about, or it's just it's just another fact, really. That is just the victim.
Yeah.
Without saying, ooh, it was Bob, whatever. So easily turn into just another
John Doe,
another,
isn't it?
Yeah, rather than this was a person who had a whole life. And who knows, there could be, he may have been married, he may have had children, or brothers and sisters, and all this sort of stuff, and we will never know. And
there have been investigations, and as I said on that BBC article in 2017, in the area, they reopened the case and they found DNA evidence from the court files or from the investigation files, certainly in the 2000s. So it inspired the police to go, okay, let's appeal to families across this region to see if you've got any DNA. And loads of people came forward, but they still were no closer to finding. Yeah. So far, they haven't found who it was.
I mean, that would only work on the assumption that he did have children.
He's got to have had parents. Maybe he was the only child, but maybe...
He'd be dead by now.
Yeah, I know, but then if they had brother and sister,
then the DNA
line might continue. But again, it assumes, is he from that area?
Well, yes. With a brogue, he could be, as you say, he could well be...
Hitchhiking, travelling from place to place, and he was elsewhere. A vagrant. And maybe he did have people who cared about him, but just because Alfred Rose did not want to pay child support, he had to die.
Ah. Boo,
boo. But he hanged, there you are.
Well, as he should.
So, what do you think, people? Do you know of the Blazing Car murder? Do you have theories about who this man could be? I mean, if you do, please tell the police.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
That would be
Many
amazing.
People want to know.
Absolutely. But, yeah, it's amazing what people will do to just cover their own tracks. You know, few, hopefully, resort to murder. But maybe there are more cases that we should cover on this show involving people who fake their own death. And Indeed. Took someone else's life in order to do it. Tell us if you know any stories, any ones that you want us to cover. But most importantly, I think it's time for you to fire up a 100-year-old cigar.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. Oh, God.
You are very happy, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, it's great. It's really good. I appreciate it's got a lot of ingredients that you will not find in your average cocktail cabinet.
It's smarter than the average cocktail.
Yeah, Benedictine, Chinar. Things like that. They're not things that you're going to have them just lying around the place. If you really like your cocktails, go and get the stuff. It's a really good drink.
If you're the sort of person who likes the Red Hook that we've done before, some of those really punchy, stirred, heavy, dark cocktails, build up your poisonous cabinet over time. You can. And enjoy it. But it's one to invest in. So, Nick, obviously we've had our competition running on Instagram this week.
We have lots of entries. It's very exciting.
Yes.
Lots of comments. Of very fun things to read through.
We have an amazing competition for you guys to win your very own cocktail set and an edition of Difford's Guide to Cocktails. The Bible and the perfect kit for you if you want to start making cocktails or if you want to carry on making cocktails but with really, really stylish stuff. We have signed the book. You can enter the competition just by going to Instagram, liking the competition post, comment on it, tag a friend, tell us what's your personal poison, and share it as much as you can. We will be drawing the entries on Saturday night, so there's not long for you to enter it, but go for it, and we will announce the winners very, very soon.
Yeah, that's very exciting.
If you haven't already, come and join us on Patreon. Lots of extra episodes on there. Tell your friends to also join Patreon and just to enjoy the poisonous cabinet because it's fantastic. We also have a very big birthday coming up. I'm just going to say it right now. Nick, Nick has a very big birthday coming up in March.
I'm not old.
Oh, yes, he does. So we've got some really good episodes coming out that coincide with the end of season 2. May take a tiny break between season 2 and season 3, but we are planning a special roundup episode for the end of season 2, talking about your favourite episodes from The Poisoner's Cabinet. Who have been the best figures that we have covered? What's the greatest poison of them all? What have been the best and worst cocktails? Please start sending us your suggestions of things that we should cover in that special episode. Thanks for listening, guys. We have been the people inside The Poisoner's Cabinet. We will see you next week. And remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Oh.